Well, I think we better start. Let's do a review. We started off last time talking about the difference in our method, where normal thinking is linear thinking. It goes from A to B to C. And our way of thinking is associative thinking, and it circles around a given element. And we don't look for continuity between our discussions, but we look at the relationship of that discussion to the center point that we're always going around. And I said what I will try to do, one of the things I will try to do, is always tell you what the central point is. What's the main image? And I think that's a good method to begin with, is to always ask yourself, where am I? Where are we? What are we talking about? Because sometimes we... Here she comes. Good news or bad news? Good news, okay. Thank you. Oh. And we have croissants as well. Croissants as well. Thank you. Do I need to call anybody or?
It's the Roberts Library.
No.
Actually, I couldn't remember your number, and she said an 849-1205 is the contact number. I said, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
So they will call me.
Okay. So we meet at Roberts Library, which is the other building from the.
It's in the main church building.
Main church. Where? Where we met before.
Where we used to go for Friends of Young.
Yep. Oh, okay.
Went across the street and we go in the back door and it's a lot. We can park right along that.
It's real Harris. And
Roberts, I was thinking Roberts Park at the church way downtown.
And I will send everybody, I'll remind everybody. Okay. I'll either a call or an email. Yeah. If you don't hear from me, don't hesitate to contact me.
I asked her through May, and she went all the calendar.
Oh, super. Oh, great.
That should be all right.
That's super. Thank you, Carl. Right. That's a nice room.
Worked.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's the nicest room we've met in. It's wood paneled. It's got a fireplace. It does magic things. It just starts up.
Does it have a table?
It's got a table. It's not as big as this. So we'll have to kind of double up, I guess.
Yeah, but pull chairs up.
We can pull chairs up, yeah. It's pretty comfortable. Well, thanks again.
You can sit on the sofa,
too. You can sit on the sofa. Except if you nod off, then I shoot spitballs at you. We were just reviewing Carl. That last time we talked about our difference in method, associative thinking versus linear thinking. Associative thinking always circles around an image, a point, and that I will see it as one of my jobs to always remind you what the point is. And then I said, for your own purposes, when you're reading Jung, particularly the later Jung, the earlier Jung is still a little linear, but the later Jung is totally unlinear. Always stop and ask yourself, where am I? What's the point? What's the main point that we are circling around? I think that's very helpful. So some of the main points that we've done. Hot wind. Talked about the spirit and desire. These are just the main ones. Then the reference to being trodden in the mire, which she said, has to do with the fact that wisdom, the same words are used to describe wisdom as are used to describe the end point of the alchemical opus, that it is said to be trodden in the mire. Same phrase. What that means is that we're going to be seeing that Sophia comes into this guy's experience, and then an alchemical process of integrating her begins. And with respect to the book, it's laid out in the two parts of the book. This first section, chapters, I think, was it 1 through 5, are the presentation of Sophia. And we've gone chapters 1 through 5 are the presentation of Sophia. It's the presentation of the experience. We've gone quite slowly up to now, but I think you'll see we know who she is. So we're going to go pretty fast. We may even get through 5 chapters today. We'll go pretty fast because she just keeps saying the same thing again and again. in those chapters. Maybe one or two points will slow down. And then the second part of the book, chapter six and following, are the beginnings of that alchemical reaction in the psyche of the person who had this experience to try to integrate it. So these first chapters were talking about Sophia, and then the next half, chapter six and following, will be the process to integrate Sophia. So it will become both about Sophia and about alchemy. Then where we left off was talking about all the implications of this image of the flintstone and the sparks. The couple of points we mentioned, through a reference in the text, she made the point that Sophia is both a personal soul and a world soul. And I tried to give you an example from Pali, how our own dreams and the dynamics of the historical moment sometimes converge. So that we're a vessel for the historical development. What?
Hi there. Talk
a little louder. Oh. Yes, school's out today.
Sorry about that.
No?
I guess it is school's out. Huh? Mm-hmm. Then we talked about the theme of the mind, that the Sophia is the... it is a world mind, and our mind is a particularization of it, and that's a medieval understanding of mind. We should have opened that screen. I think we're just have to put up with it, huh? And then we talked about Susan's dream a little bit. Sort of parentheses about how do we make use of this material? And that is, these are thoughts, but we have to live in the experiences, not just the thoughts. We talked about absolute knowledge and luminosity. And that then got into a discussion of the archetype and the psychoid. Are you going to be able to do this?
Should we join them?
Maybe they have to use that room today, huh?
Yeah. Or maybe we could find another room.
Maybe, or they could go down to the other end. Is that a big room in there? And forget.
No, I meant they went down to the other. Oh, is it?
We do the hokey pokey too. And the next point is making that Sophia really is the hokey pokey. And that's what it's all about.
She's got pearls for eyes and some other part with. Never mind.
No luck, huh? Oh. Thank you, Zach.
You obviously are very good with people.
Tails are the other end of the room. They're right up in space, I think. I think you're gone.
Okay. Thank you. I think it would have been too much. Okay. So we left off page 173.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes. You had a comment.
Yeah. Bob had an astrology reading, and one thing in there, the woman was talking about doing like a ritual experience in the darkness and coming out. The next day he went to work and there was no electricity and he had to work in a warehouse with just driving the headlights on his forklift all day.
That's a synchronicity.
We thought about that. My God, you know, how that world gives you information.
Right. Mm-hmm. Huh. Was it because of the storm that he had?
Yeah.
Okay. 173. Now, again, we're going to pick up the pace probably because we've heard Sophia. We're going to keep hearing about Sophia, and it's not going to be anything new. It'll just be new takes. So I'll try to pick up some speed and then just focus on the main points. Blessed is the man that shall find this science and into whom this prudence of Saturn floweth. In all thy ways think on her, and she shall direct thy steps. Saturn there, I think, would mean the long term. And it means that Sophia is a long-term prudence. A senior Seth, the wise man and the discerning and the ingenious in judgment understandeth her, and his spirits have been enlightened by the Liber, I guess that's Aggregationis, which that's the name of an alchemical text. For then every spirit bursteth into flood and floweth its desire. Blessed is he who meditateth upon my words. Okay, that's one of the things we'll be looking at. The spirit bursteth into flood and followeth its desire. The other theme what we'll be working on comes from the next couple of lines, the next sentence, where in the text of Senior, who's an alchemist, he defines tincture like as that which allows potentiality to turn into actuality. Now, tincture is another word for lapis, which is another word for the end point of the alchemical opus, which has been used as a metaphor for Sophia through the allusion to that link in the phrase trodden through the mire. So see, this is really circular thinking, but we're looking at associative descriptions and lumping them all together. Nothing is going to be new here, but to hear it again, the first phrase that we'll look at is this theme of turning potentiality into actuality. Now, all that, I'll sum it up and then we can look at the text. What that's striving at is, in the alchemist's mind, when they made that final product, it made things happen in the world. So it's a kind of a magic. Not exactly magic, because it can only happen with God's will. So they try to evoke a revelation, you might say. They try to evoke God descending into the world and doing something in the world, healing somebody or something like that, or producing a certain result in a material process. That's just her point is, we're not the first ones that have seen this question of the relationship between the spirit and matter. That at the right moment, in their mind, this alchemical process produced a result in the outer world. And what we're working with in synchronicity is an analogous process where an inner state is echoed in the outer world. That's the whole point of that. See, it's nothing new. She's just rehashing what we've already done. And that she does 174, 175, 176, 177, just a little key phrase, go down about two-thirds of the way down, produces material effects outside the body.
Where are you?
Page 177.
Where?
About two-thirds of the way down. See where it says Avicenna there on the right? Go down one, two, three, four lines.
One which produces
material effects outside the body. Well, that's a description of a Muslim alchemist. And again, the point is simply, she's looking for other places in literature where this idea of a parallel between inner and outer is described for kind of historical basis or historical grounding for synchronicity. Nothing new.
Are you also saying it starts inner, then it comes outer? Is that what you're saying? Or is it the other way as well?
That's a good question. You know, to be precise, I think what these people came to is that it's neither. It's something somewhere else that surfaces in two places. And this something somewhere else is Sophia.
A divine causation?
Well, that would be putting it in religious language.
Okay. And Jungian language?
Well, Jung's a phenomenologist, and he just observes that something happens. You know, this is, I guess if you ask for an explanation, it would be that there's a parallelism in structures between the psyche and matter. What's behind that, we don't know. The religious person is going to say God. Jung just says, I don't know.
Are you saying that all synchronicity, Sophia, is behind it?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is very much speaking in terms of causality.
Right.
And Jung's idea was acausal in that the unus was outside of matter and spirit.
Right.
A common substrate.
Yeah.
So that when Avicenna says that the soul can affects the body,
right,
heals the sick, then Jung wouldn't put it that way because he wouldn't see a causal effect.
Right. Right. But just to remember Jung's method, he looks for something and he thinks he's found something new. This idea of synchronicity, it was for him a new discovery as far as he was concerned. And then he says to himself, am I the first person that's ever had this thought in the whole world? And then he goes back through the history of culture to see if other people might have had the same or similar experience and described it in the same or similar ways. And sure enough, when he went to the alchemist, he found a similar description. Now, he doesn't do that to prove anything, just to tell himself that he is working within a continuum. And he would say he has refined their understanding. But he goes to their descriptions to help him widen his grasp of what's going on, although he ultimately is going to describe it differently. They're describing it causally, that you produce this magical result as the end point of your alchemical process, and then something happens. And he's saying, I'm not accepting the causal dimension of it. So he refines it a bit. But to equate you with his method, when he comes up with these new experiences, he simply goes back to other traditions to see if anyone else has said something similar to Jung. He found a similar description in the Muslim East, and certainly in Western alchemy. So that's all that's going on. Again, if you're new to this stuff, these are tributaries. These aren't main points. The main points we pretty much discussed. Now, then we just go around and look for other places where it's been similarly discussed. Sometimes you can learn something from the descriptions, but the main point, I think, is to say we're not the only ones who have said this. Is that workable? So that takes us up to 178. So all those pages are just working through that idea of the potential becoming actual. And then on 178, let me just read you the summing up sentences to that discussion, middle of the page. In psychological terms, the constellations in the sky are where the archetypes of the collective unconscious appear in projection, in such a way that in contrast to myths, fairy tales, and other elaborations of the archetype, its time quality is also taken into account. So this is nothing new, right? You're just hearing this again. The individual psyche also, as Avi Sen remembers, that Muslim alchemist, is right in this, is instrumentally the place of realization for the archetype, which in itself is transpersonal and in its lower reaches even non-psychic. Now that was our whole discussion about psychoid. Does that all sound familiar? This is just a summing up. An archetype is constituted, that it becomes a realizable power having real effects only when a specific attitude of consciousness prevails. Avicenna formulates this by saying that the constellation is brought about by science, that is, by the right understanding. So science there meaning knowledge, not meaning what we mean by science. Science is the production of the right imagination, the right symbols. So that is simply a summing up of what we've done. That all sound okay. If not, holler. Okay, next point is this business of the desire and the spirit, which begins on 179. In the text, it was, every spirit bursteth into flood and followeth its desire. Now, again, nothing new. Just rehashing the same arguments, but giving us a chance to hear it again. It's a very interesting point, and I'm going to read you maybe a page for it. These amplifications seem to me necessary in order to elucidate the obscure passages in Aurora about the flowing of the spirit. That's that line I just referred back to. They also seem to justify my conjecture, well, this is not important, that this particular alchemical text was really written by so-and-so, but not important for our purposes. But now, picking up, the flowing of the spirit means that it was seized by wisdom, so that the soul of the alchemist not only attained to gnosis, to knowledge, but could exert magical effects in the material realm. Nothing new, what we just talked about, right? By a reading of this particular text, the text says, now it's where it gets interesting, the spirit bursts into flood and follows its desire. The word for desire in Latin is concupiscentia. Now, that doesn't just mean desire. That's why she's going into this. Concupiscentia means unbridled desire. It means lascivious desire with a definite negative connotation to it. You might almost say it means wanton desirousness.
Sinful.
Sinful. Yeah, right. Yes, thank you. The idea she's going to be playing with is how this text twists that idea of sinful. In ecclesiastical language, generally meant sinful desire, the flesh. The sentence in Aurora is based on a mistranslation of Senior's Arabic text. In the original, Senior says that by the inspiration of Allah, he discovered the secret of the preparation and thereby the tincture which changes things from potentiality into actuality. In this process, the spirit is freed from desire. So sit with that for a minute. The Arabic, and I think fundamentally Christian view, is that Sophia is a spirit which frees you from desire. So you get to a place beyond desire by being freed from desire by Sophia. But by a slip of the pen, slip in quotes. In the Latin translation, but the Latin translation says that the tincture was hidden lest the spirit should recognize its desire and flow. So one says the spirit helps you free from desire. The other text, which was a slip of the pen, where the unconscious insinuates itself in the text, says that the spirit helps you flow with your desire. You see what an enormous difference that is. So the way we have been talking about it is the latter. That Sophia is what comes out of going with your desire and then working with it consciously. The original formulation of that, and I think I'd say from the moralistic standpoint, you see, is that there was a tendency to help for this to be understood as to help you get away from your desire. But despite their intentions, the unconscious of one of these transcribers slipped in and changed it to just the meaningful way that we're working with it. That's why I think this is so interesting. We theologically, these people would have said one thing, but through a slip of the pen, something else was said. And that is much truer to the essential nature of Sophia that we're trying to understand, that's so important for our purposes today. So you can see in that slip of the pen how the unconscious is preparing the way for the future, despite themselves. So that we're talking about here is a truth of the personality, not a truth of dogma. And it shows you how there's been a separation between the dogmatic understanding of things and the natural understanding of things. And it's just that tension that this material is meant to address.
It's been in the form of the Garden of Eden, that it went the dogmatic route, and then it also went, I mean, that's where she...
There was a tendency to make her, to sanitize her.
Right.
And this guy's unconscious would let that happen. That's why she so finds that so interesting. So it's a small point, but it, hopefully it again stresses the validity of what we're trying to understand here.
And she uncovered this in her own translations of material, the source materials, or is she?
Yeah, yeah. She would have gone to the original texts.
She's a sharp-eyed reader.
She is a sharp-eyed reader. She is that. The author of Aurora evidently took this obscure sentence of Senior's to mean that spirit can accomplish the difficult and hidden preparation which it recognizes when it recognizes the root of its own striving, namely concupiscentia. So that woman that had the affair, remember, and etc. See, that was concupiscentia. I just want to have sex. That's concupiscentia. And out of that came increased knowledge and an awareness of the direction of her life. That is the spirit beginning to flow from concupiscentia. And that's how the rewriting the text conveys the issue, where the earlier version of the text was trying to separate the two. So that's the main point. Over to 181. So two main points out of those. That it's a historical precedent for synchronicity in one quote, and the other is how you can see the unconscious articulates the deeper meaning of the relationship between desire and spirit, which we are trying to express. And this came out several hundred years ago. Okay. 181. And Solomon, my son, put her about thy neck and write in the tables of thy heart, and thou shalt find, say to wisdom, thou art my sister. That's the key thing.
You must be on 182.
Yeah, 182, sorry. Yeah, what we just did covers up through 181. The point there is incest. The importance of the incest theme was first uncovered by Freud. That's not news to anybody, I'm sure. But Jung came back to it. And like everything with Freud, said it is partially correct and partially too limiting. What I find it really tragically in my work is folks who have seen what I call paint-by-number therapists, and as soon as they have a dream of incest, then they're told they've had sexual abuse in childhood, and they don't know it, and then they spend years running after this memory that never happened. Meanwhile, the events of their own life go on in a haphazard and destructive fashion. Because incest imagery does not always refer to incest. It also can refer to a combination of two things that want to be together and shouldn't. Shouldn't from the standpoint of collective morality. So the difficulty that Sophia will pose to this man who is chaste and where Sophia represents concupiscentia, his unconscious is trying to get him to put two things together which in his world are just forbidden. And when that is the case, very often the dreams will use incest imagery. Just as far as the real incest thing goes, it was Jung's feeling that where there is real physical incest, and of course, you know, that can be a reality, it's because there is in the perpetrator a situation developing where the incest archetype is activated, because two things should be brought together in their life. And when it's not dealt with consciously, it's projected and literalized. So behind a real physical incest is always a failed intrapsychic incest on the part of the perpetrator. Does that make sense? If you go back and you think about, you know, the alchemical process, which we've talked about, which is they start with this pile of junk, and then they heat it, and the pile of junk is made up of all these conglomerated mixtures, and what that would equate to personally is an individual who's fragmented. Who does one thing one moment, one thing the next, says one thing, does another, unreliable, does all sorts of conflicting things, and their life gets going nowhere because they're always undermining themselves. That's the confused mixture of opposites, psychologically speaking. And there's the person is not aware, they're not aware that they're continually sabotaging themselves. They feel okay. The problem is with everybody else, of course, if you talk to them. So that they're unaware that their own complexity, their own conflict, their own sabotaging is what's getting their life in a mess. Now, the alchemical process puts that in a chemical idiom, and this is how Jung studied it then, that when that process that materialist worked on, the chemical process, these inner conflicting chemical elements separate. And then as it's cooked further, they recombine. And when they recombine, then the lapis or the tincture or the philosopher's stone, the endpoint, the goal, it's got many different names, is produced. And that then contains all those previously heterogeneously mixed parts in an organized and meaningful whole. And so the lapis is all those parts reorganized and united into a whole. We see one of the, there are two operations in that. There's the separation, and then there's the reunion of all those parts. And that reunion in dreams is often expressed sexually. So what looks like sex dreams very often are not sex dreams. They're union dreams. Sex is just the metaphor. And very often that union is, when that union is particularly threatening to the ego, that union is depicted as incestuous. It's that disgusting to the ego. You got to remember how disgusting incest is to the primitive mind. You know, maybe I've mentioned this, but if you kill somebody in a primitive tribe, that's no big deal. But if you have incest, you're a goner. That is the worst crime in the world. There is this fundamental abhorrence of anything incestuous.
Wait.
Any primal tribe.
And why in Egypt did they...
Except for royalty. Because, see, they had the divine power to overcome them. It's very, very weird. Very weird. And it shows up in this incest theme, shows up when a union is being asked for that is as disgusting to the dreamer as incest would be to a primal person. You know, it's more than disgusting. It's awesomely disgusting. See what I mean? It's like mana bad. So, now think of what this text is asking Thomas Aquinas to do. Here's a guy who's devoted his whole life to purity, and is in a 1,200-year-old tradition of purity, and he is the apogee of that tradition. And he's having dreams of the sacredness of sinful desire. That just would blow somebody like that apart. It doesn't disturb us so much because we're okay with that. We've integrated this. But for the purity of that time, the purity of that man, this was an abhorrence. Everything in his life was against this. So it is so threatening to him to consider, to his ego, to the stability of everything he believes in, to consider this, that the text uses the incest image to show how much this union is feared. So just to realize how incest can be used in two different ways in dreams. Sometimes when it shows up in dreams, it is about either physical or psychological incest with a parent. Physical incest is obvious. Psychological incest is where the child is more important to the parent than the mate. So, where there is a disturbed parental-child relationship, it can appear. It can also appear in a very symbolic way. And you see, in the first case, you try to get the person away from the incest. In the second case, you try to get them into the incest. And that's then where, Sandy, that sacredness of the king, and that strength that was attributed to the sacredness of the king, the queen, is what we're trying to access in the therapeutic work, to give them the strength to overcome this. Yeah.
In other words, what blew Thomas's mind was the fact that he may have had a heavenly mother as well as a heavenly father. God is not strictly male.
Well, that's certainly the implication, but I think on a much more concrete level, the first answer I give you will not be complete, but it's that sex was knocking on his door.
Oh, well, yeah, well, that's...
Sex is what?
Knocking on his door. But that's not the terribly threatening thing. The terribly threatening thing is that he's being asked to realize, and that's sacred. See, it's not just about sex. It's about turning a whole worldview upside down. And the Catholic Church has still not solved that. I told some of you the dream about the priest, the risen Christ. Shall I tell it again?
Yeah.
To give you an idea, I mean, it's just how modern this is. I was working with a priest, and actually, he's not from here. He's actually a very nice guy. I knew some people at the parish, and he was a liberal priest. He was very understanding. And he had a dream that, his first dream, I think, in therapy, that he was to witness the resurrection of Christ. And the crucified Christ was brought in a casket by pallbearers. And he watched the coffin lid rise, and Christ arose. And she was a woman. And she wanted to make love. And he ran. And he terminated the next week. See, they just cannot deal with that. That the Christ and sex are the same thing. And that's what's hitting Thomas. And not just sex, but sex as a portal to the divine, to the spirit, to the divine guidance, to the reorientation, as we're working with it. So that's why this incest image appears, because it's that threatening to him.
So in other words, this establishing of this relationship to the unconscious material on the personal journey of individuation, that can sometimes then stimulate these dreams of having incestuous.
Right. When the challenges that come are particularly threatening, then the image can be, the way that the union is expressed can be incestuous. Mm-hmm. Two ways. So if you use our jargon, now some of you will know this jargon, incest can have a reductive or a prospective meaning. And it's certainly behind our idea of a lot of the feelings that get going in therapy, these sexual feelings that get going on in a heterosexual. I've never worked with a homosexual transference, but heterosexual transference, it's often this is behind it. The relationship is sexualized because it has a symbolic significance, which is both desired and threatening. It's not easy. Okay, so that's incest. 182, again, nothing particularly new here. For to meditate upon her is a most natural and subtle understanding, which bringeth her to perfection. That's the phrase, bringeth her to perfection. And what we understand by that now, to bring Sophia to perfection, is to take that concupiscentia and find the spiritual meaning of it. a couple of phrases she uses. Again, I'm going quite fast because you know all this. We're just hearing it in different words. 184. You see the beginning, third paragraph, the idea? Go up three lines. The intervention of human consciousness has a perfecting influence on wisdom herself. So, just what we've been saying. The consciousness has to intercede and ask, what's the meaning of this experience? Over on 185, again, just hearing it in different words. Second paragraph, going to 5 lines. In alchemical language, this would be the extraction of the truth from matter by means of the right theory. Theory here, I think you could roughly substitute understanding. It's a bit more than that, but that'll work for the moment.
Say it again. Where was that?
Theory? Oh. Second paragraph, 4 lines. In alchemical language, this would be the extraction. See, the idea is the extraction. You extract an understanding of how your life is to develop is meant to come to you through this experience of concupiscentia or desire. Uh, 186, saying the same thing in different words. Now he goes to a different alchemist, Gerhard Dorn, German. Go down 8 lines. In the human body is concealed a certain metaphysical substance. So same idea, that the body is the desirous experience, and contained within that desirous experience is meant to be a lesson. That would be the metaphysical substance.
Are you implying acting it out or awareness?
Well, that's a tough question. In your own personal life?
Yeah.
As opposed to professional life, I meant.
Right.
In your personal life...
Well, even either.
Well, you can't act it out in your professional life.
Right, right.
In your personal life...
But people have strong desires all the time.
If I had to give you an average, I think I lean toward encouraging people who are single to act it out. With caveats, you know, if I hear somebody's been in the 10th bad relationship or 10th abusive relationship, no. But most of the time I think we are prudes. And like that woman I told you about, she was single. Actually, she was still married, but she was getting divorced. The guy was divorced. It was wrong. Mm-hmm. But I said, why not?
Well, I'm getting that familiar. What are they implying here? Like, you can have a strong feeling towards someone and not act it out and maybe be reawakened to life in a new way. Are they saying that?
Yes, they are.
Okay, they're not saying that it has to be acted out.
No, they're not saying it has to be acted out. No, they're not saying it has to be acted out.
I understand that.
But, again, I think on the whole, we are so anemic that if people genuinely do. What I see the danger of our conventional morality is people have a desire and they shut it right down.
Without thinking.
It's wrong.
Okay.
Oh, it says something's wrong with my marriage. Okay. I just was seeing a client who had this absolutely harmless flirtation with a jogging partner. She was a fundamentalist Christian. And the wife said, if you don't stop this, I'm going to divorce you. She stopped it. See, that is what the error I generally see. Where we have to be aware and live with the experience and not act it out. The trick is allowing ourselves to experience it.
Okay.
with, if you're in a committed relationship. Yeah.
Could you consider that being kind of like a symbolic representation or even like a ritualistic thing without necessarily being physical?
Yeah. You know? If you can do it.
If you're aware of it, mm-hmm. and are saying, okay, I need to realize I can't actually do this, but I need to embrace the thought of it in mm-hmm. my mind symbolically. Mm-hmm.
You see, this is where I become a little cautious. I think, in the best of all possible worlds, with two mature married people, meet each other, and are erotically attracted to each other, and yet committed to a relationship, that they can develop a friendship, acknowledge the erotic feelings that are there, and not act on them.
What about writing about it? What about...
Well, you see, you're shortcutting this business of communicating it to another human being.
Oh.
And that's... Sometimes you can't, but sometimes you don't, simply out of conventional morality. You see, it's irritating. You see how locked we are into the medieval value system.
The Victorian world got more recent.
Yeah. There are, again, practically, the ideal is to be able to form a friendship in which these feelings are experienced and not acted on. If that is possible. Sometimes I personally think you have to err on the side of acting it out. That it comes with Sophia. Or I would say, if you make a if you slip and act it out, I'm not going to judge you for it. Let's put it that way. Because we are still living under this law that the flesh is bad. And you can see it in the reaction to what I'm saying in this room. With single folks, I don't think it's so much an issue. And I think this is part of what the 20s are about. You know, have a desire, follow it, learn from it. Some people never did that in their 20s and 30s. So at 40 and 50, they're saying... Oh, like a little bit of that.
Gary, I gotta tell you a thing. Yeah. I think I was too young to be a flapper and too old to be a hippie.
Never too old to be a hippie.
However, I didn't miss any of it.
Okay, should we take a break?